From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon. On Saturday, President Obama made a chess move on Syria.
I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress.
A Washington surprise. We'll also hear from author Amanda Ripley about the smartest kids in the world and how they got that way. And an eerie broadcast from Night Vale, which may be near Area 51.
If you see something, say nothing and drink to forget.
And the author of a new novel spans generations. The woman who lost her soul gets compared to Graham Greene.
When you meet powerful men or just read about them in the newspapers, you see that they don't have a sense of boundaries.
Also, the CIA admits to a 60-year-old coup in Iran. And remember Bikini Kill? Front woman Kathleen Hanna is back.
I'm still as pissed off as ever before. I think I'm just a little bit more directed.
And finally, Nobel laureate, Irish poet Seamus Heaney passed away this week. We'll take a look at a conversation I had with him in 2008 and a remembrance. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. It was a stunner today for pundits on the Potomac. President Obama announced in the Rose Garden that while he has the authority to unilaterally attack Syria for its use of chemical weapons, he won't use it. Only 24 hours after Secretary of State John Kerry made the case for military action, the president made the case for congressional approval.
We all know there are no easy options, but I wasn't elected to avoid hard decisions, and neither were the members of the House and the Senate.
The social media world in Syria and the Middle East lit up, with Syrian rebels and other Assad opponents saying, "What did we go through all that for?" asked a woman in Damascus. Assad is victorious. But Congress seemed generally to welcome the deliberation, a debate the president said the country should have. We'll get more on congressional response in a few minutes, but first, NPR's Scott Horsley has more on the president's about-face.
President Obama says he's prepared to order a military strike on Syria to deter any additional use of chemical weapons and degrade the Syrian government's ability to carry out such attacks. That was hardly a surprise. The president's been telegraphing such an action all week. It was the second decision Obama announced in the White House Rose Garden, though, that caught many observers off guard.
Having made my decision as commander-in-chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example, as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
And so, without ceding any legal ground, the president said he will ask Congress to authorize a military strike.
While I believe I have the authority to carry out this military action without specific congressional authorization, I know that the country will be stronger if we take this course and our actions will be even more effective.
White House aides acknowledge there are risks to this approach. While a yes vote from Congress would strengthen the president's hand, he could also suffer a stinging rebuke from lawmakers, much as British Prime Minister David Cameron did this past week when the British Parliament voted against military action in Syria. Obama's move is a gamble that surprised Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson Center.
I have to tell you, I found this to be remarkable and extraordinary. Five times in the last 30-some years, presidents have initiated military action without seeking formal authorization from Congress. I found it remarkable that having made the case for a limited strike, the president has now surrendered the initiative to a legislative process that could now risk it.
As late as yesterday, the administration wasn't planning to seek congressional approval. Aides say none of the congressional leadership was even asking for such a vote. The president decided he would go to Congress only after a 45-minute walk around the South Lawn last night with Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough. White House officials aren't saying what the president would do if Congress voted against military action, only that they're confident lawmakers will give a green light. Obama says he understands the reservation some members of Congress have, but he argues the U.S. cannot ignore a chemical weapons attack that killed more than 1,400 people.
If we won't enforce accountability in the face of this heinous act, what does it say about our resolve to stand up to others who flout fundamental international rules? To governments who would choose to build nuclear arms, to terrorists who would spread biological weapons, to armies who carry out genocide. We cannot raise our children in a world where we will not follow through on the things we say.
Administration officials provided a telephone briefing for members of the Senate this afternoon on intelligence surrounding the chemical weapons attack. There will be another session tomorrow for House members in person, and that will include classified information. Congress is not scheduled to return from recess for another week, and the administration plans to use that time to build its argument for military authorization. Obama says he'll also be seeking support from other countries around the world.
Privately, we've heard many expressions of support from our friends, but I will ask those who care about the writ of the international community to stand publicly behind our action.
The decision to seek congressional authorization will delay any military strike for at least a week, but Obama says military leaders have assured him they'll be equally ready to attack tomorrow, next week, or a month from now. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's often said that great teachers should be paid more than great athletes. Well, in South Korea, one rock star teacher acting as a free agent makes $4 million. But do highly paid teachers really make kids smarter? Author Amanda Ripley crisscrossed the world to find out. In her new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way, she tags along with American school kids who left home on exchange programs and landed in classrooms from South Korea to Finland. And she joins us to share what's working and what's not in classrooms around the world. Amanda Ripley, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
To begin, why don't you remind us where American kids stand with respect to kids in all other parts of the world in terms of how well-educated we are?
American 15-year-olds perform about 26th in the world in a test of critical thinking in math, 17th in science, and 12th in reading. And our high school graduation rate is now below that of about 20 other nations.
So it means it's something that we need to address, obviously.
Yeah, and I think we've tried to address it in our defense so many years. We've tried and tried, and it starts to feel hopeless. But what's exciting is if you look around the world, you see wild improvement and change. And so we haven't really changed much, but other countries have changed a lot.
You went around the world to look at how well kids were doing. Tell me a little bit about the premise of this. What were you looking for?
I kept hearing about these countries, you know, that you hear about on the headlines, Finland, Korea, that were outperforming us in education year after year. But I couldn't quite imagine what it was like to be a kid there. What is it actually like? And how did these countries get that way?
Let's start with Korea. You follow a young man to Korea, and you say there were two models that you were looking at. One was the Enlightenment model, but Korea was the model of what is grueling.
Right. That's exactly right. It's kind of an extreme version of the pressure cooker model of education that you see all over Asia, where kids go to school all day long and then they go to tutoring academies all night long and they study so many hours that they're exhausted when they get to class again in the morning. That is one way to get to the top of the world. I don't think anyone, including everyone I met in Korea, would argue that it's the best way. Eric had gone from Minnesota, which is one of the highest performing states in the U.S., to Busan, South Korea. So he thought he knew what pressure and high-stakes testing were, but he did not know, he realized, that there was a whole other league, and it was shocking, really, how hard these kids were working.
What is the Hagwon?
Hagwons are the Korean word for after-school tutoring academy. Tutoring is actually, I think, understating it because it sounds kind of homespun. In fact, this industry is bigger than the public school industry in Korea. It is huge. It is traded on the stock exchange. There's investments from major American banks in this industry because 70% of Korean teenagers participate in this world in some manner.
And you focus in your book on a teacher there called Kim Ki-hoon. Tell us more about him.
This was unlike any teacher I'd ever interviewed in the U.S. First of all, his office was in a luxury sky high-rise in Seoul, and he had 30 employees, and he makes about $4 million a year. The way he's making that money is through this Hagwon industry. He gives a few in-person lectures and then puts them on the internet, and kids pay like $4 an hour to see his lectures online, and that's how he's making this money. And he himself is critical of this because it requires some amount of money in order to participate, unlike public school.
Let's contrast that with other kids that you followed. One of them, Kim, from Oklahoma, decides to go to Finland. Why did the Oklahoman want to go there?
She wanted to see the world. She was curious. She'd never left the United States. She had a single mother who was a teacher in rural Oklahoma, where she was born. And she read that Finland had the smartest kids in the world and that they liked heavy metal music and strong coffee and had a good sense of humor. And she said, I want to go there.
Because she's 15 at the time.
She's 15 at the time. She gets placed in rural Finland and ends up in high school there, living in with a host family for 1 year.
How good were her teachers?
There were some who were stronger than others, but all of them, she felt like, really wanted to be there. In Finland, getting into teacher training college is as hard as getting into MIT here. It's literally the top 10% of applicants are even accepted to begin the process, which is a really critical piece of this. I think the key to Finland's success is that they really went long on quality over quantity. So we educate twice as many teachers as we need. Finland in the late 1960s shut down all of its varying quality teacher colleges and moved them into the most elite universities. So right from the beginning, you had the best educated people becoming teachers, which led to all these other great things that we don't always even think about. Notably, the signal it sent to kids.
What else can we emulate from these examples that would make the American experience better and also make us not 26th in math, 17th in science, and 12th in everything else?
You know, I think it's actually not that complicated, believe it or not. What we want to do is fewer things better. So fewer tests that are smarter, less homework that is more challenging, makes kids have to think, even less parental involvement that's more targeted at things that actually lead to learning. I mean, American parents actually do a lot compared to parents in other countries. But those things that they do and the things, by the way, that schools ask them to do are typically not strongly related to raising a kid who's able to think critically and solve problems and make an argument. So you do see that parents are a piece of the solution here, and it doesn't often get talked about. We just say, oh, our parents aren't involved. Well, I think they're involved, just in ways that aren't particularly impactful.
Amanda Ripley is the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Amanda Ripley, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
My pleasure.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. In Night Vale, a podcast from the Twilight Zone, so to speak, strange things happen.
A friendly desert community where the sun is hot, the moon is beautiful, and mysterious lights pass overhead while we all pretend to sleep. Welcome to Night Vale.
Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink have the news of the weird covered. They're the creative masterminds behind a popular sci-fi podcast called Welcome to Night Vale. Though only a year old, the spooky Night Vale has rocketed up the iTunes ratings list to claim the number one most downloaded spot. Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink, welcome to NPR.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I loved being in Night Vale, which is set in this desert town somewhere out there, maybe the land beyond Area 51. How did you come up with the concept? Joseph?
So basically, I listen to a lot of podcasts. So I wanted to work with Jeffrey on a podcast, but I didn't want to do a podcast that was anything like any of the podcasts I was already listening to because they all already existed. And so I spent about 8 months thinking about what to make. And I've always been fascinated by conspiracy theories and also, to a lesser extent, fascinated by the Southwest desert. Fascinating things probably happen there on a regular basis. So I came up with this idea of a town in that desert where all conspiracy theories were real and we would just go from there with that understood.
Hello, listeners. To start things off, I've been asked to read this brief notice. The city council announces the opening of a new dog park at the corner of Earl and Somerset near the Ralphs. They would like to remind everyone that dogs are not allowed in the dog park. People are not allowed in the dog park. And now the news.
The dog park is one of our favorite bits. Where does this come from, Jeffrey?
It's a great setup to the whole show. It happens right at the beginning. It's one of the first news item you really get about the town of Night Vale, and sets the scene for the idea that it's a small community town. It has the mundane qualities of everyday life in small town America. As you hear more about the dog park, you realize it is completely locked down, not only physically, but somehow spiritually too. You have no concept of what's happening in there, and there aren't even people in the dog park, just hooded figures that are in and around the area. So it sets the scene of, here's a mundane, quaint American town, overrun by ghosts or spirits or conspiracies or underground societies.
Were either of you channeling Orson Welles or Ray Bradbury, Rod Serling, any of the places that have taken the American imagination to a little place that looks normal but isn't before?
I mean, it's, you know, there's this whole tradition in American storytelling of that, right? Of the small town where everything's a little off. And so I don't think it was written with those specifically in mind, but certainly there's no way of avoiding that influence when you write in that genre. The very first Night Vale thing I wrote, which is in the very first episode,
Lights.
We have this seen piece about the lights above the Arby's.
Not the glowing sign of Arby's, something higher and beyond that. We know the difference. We've caught on to their game. We understand the lights above Arby's game. Invaders from another world.
The entire tone and intent of Night Vale is in that one paragraph.
One of the things you guys do really well, I think, is blur the line between reality and fiction. For example, here's something we've all heard before. If you see something, say something, and you turn it into this.
Remember, if you see something, say nothing, and drink to forget.
Night Vale, it seems to me, does tap into the paranoia that we're expected to take for granted in this post-9/11 world.
Oh, sure. This is Jeffrey. The paranoia, taking that level of panic and internal angst and turning it into the norm in society. I think that's one of the things we love about the character of Cecil. He gives a dry radio journalist approach to the news most of the time, and he gives a sense of, like, that this is a normal way of society, that this isn't trying to create sheer panic in the reader or the listener, that we've entered dystopia. It's trying to take the dystopia model and actually make the people who live there quite happy with it.
The Boy Scouts of Night Vale have announced some slight changes to their hierarchy, which will now be the following: Cub Scout, Boy Scout, Eagle Scout, Blood Pact Scout, Weird Scout.
You've got a very creative cult following, as you are the number one podcast. And you've got a web world where people are creating for you in a sort of crowdsourced way, fan art, fan fiction, trying to depict Cecil, because, of course, we don't know exactly what he looks like.
Yeah, it's been very overwhelming kind of seeing the amount of work being made based on our work, because, you know, as a reader and as a watcher of television and as a listener to music, I'm very familiar with having someone else's work be important to you and be inspiring to you. And so to have that happen with my work, you know, to other people is a very weird experience that is kind of very new to all of us. The fact that no one knows what most of the people look like. We very intentionally leave off most physical description unless it's for, like, a joke, like mentioning that someone has spider eyes or something. Other than that, we tend to leave out physical description.
Well, there's the faceless children who deliver press releases to
right. Yeah, so if they, you know, if they're faceless, we might mention that they don't have a face, but we don't really get into hair color or height or things like that. And so we get a lot of emails, and I get a lot of emails every day being like, tell us exactly what Cecil looks like, and then a bunch of other emails every day being like, never tell us anything about what Cecil looks like.
I'm more from the never tell us exactly what Cecil looks like.
Well, I think you're going to be more pleased with where we go.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm just completely in love with the idea of the weather. That's one of my favorite parts of this. Let's hear the weather, and then I want to ask you about it.
And now, the weather.
Each episode
usually around two-thirds of the way through, Cecil throws it to the weather report. And each time we go to the weather, it is not a weather report. In the literal sense, it is simply a song.
I give you the weather.
I was poor in love. I was
also, there is kind of that beauty of calling something the weather and then having it be something else. Anything can be a weather report if you just before doing it say, this is a weather report.
What are you looking for, Jeffrey Craner? Is there an overarching storyline that guides the podcast, or do you spin one episode off of another?
We do not have an end point for the show. We have a lot of ideas that we've talked through, an arc for Cecil or an arc for some of the things going on in town and things like that.
Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner are the creators of the Welcome to Night Vale podcast. Thank you both so much for coming onto our Real World radio show.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you very much.
Bob Chakotchis has covered conflict in the Balkans and Haiti, the abuse of American power, spycraft, and the sexual politics that divide men and women. He's written both fiction and nonfiction. A National Book Award winner and professor and mentor to many younger novelists, it's been a long time since Chakotchis had a new novel. Critics are saying it's well worth waiting for. And it's an epic, a 700-page tome that spans continents and generations. He's being compared to Conrad, Green, and Mailer. The book is called The Woman Who Lost Her Soul, and the woman in question came from a real-life encounter Chakotchis had while working as a reporter in Haiti. While sitting at a hotel bar in Port-au-Prince, a striking and mysterious female photographer approached him.
This woman came and sat at my table and asked if I knew any voodoo priests. And I said, yeah, I know a lot of them. And she said, well, I'd like to meet one. This young, very beautiful woman told me that she had lost her soul. And I said, my God, what are you talking about? So we can stop there with my own personal experience and let that fester for a few years until somebody asked me to get in touch with this guy who used to be an FBI guy. Now he was a private detective.
This is a real person.
It's a real person. He called me up and he said, I have a client who's been accused of murdering his wife. I need to go to Haiti. Will you come with me? All this time I'm thinking about this young woman who told me she lost her soul. And I'm thinking, I think I'd like to go just to get a sense of this murder in this place where it's impossible to solve any murder. So we walked through the murder for a weekend and I thought, this is the woman who lost her soul. Now I think I know how to begin writing my book.
You've written five books at least inside this one tome. From Haiti, we go to Croatia during World War II. There's a long, long, long section in the 90s in Istanbul. Finally, America, Special Forces, the CIA. Is there a thread here? Is there a reason that you wanted to go to so many places?
I think the easiest way to answer that is because America is in so many places. I consider myself a writer who writes about American expatriates. And, you know, if I have any overt cause as a writer besides trying to write the best prose I can, it's to try to make Americans have a more visceral feeling about how America impacts everybody in the world.
Let's go into this section, and this is where your book can either be read as a thriller, as a murder mystery, or a spy novel. The Friends of Gulf. You know, some of them are in the CIA, some of them are in Black Ops. They all do shady things, and we meet them on a Gulf Lynx. Read us that section, would you?
You could find them some days between temperate equinoxes on the Lynx outside the district, convened on the first tee in those final years of the millennium, chins tucked and heads bowed and testicles snug, smacking their drives 250 yards and beyond toward the middle of the fairway. They made the game look easy and natural and powered by grace, dialed into the sweet and the straight, their balls nested in a little egg-like cluster out at the edge of your vision. It was the kind of perfect placement you get from guidance systems orbiting the planet and that tempted you to think they had the course wired up, had punched the coordinates. What they called themselves with wry half-smiles was the Friends of Golf, FOG, F-O-G, perhaps an advertent self-parody. The world the Friends of Golf were fond of saying is not run from a house on Pennsylvania Avenue. They were the architects of the unseen, the fabrication of interlocking subterranean networks and processes that form the human infrastructure of what are known as deep events. Deep events evolved in deep time and produced tectonic shifts in human affairs. Something happens, something obviously cataclysmic, where even the unexpected was not to be mistaken for a coincidence. There are no coincidences, and everything counts.
We meet the father of this photographer, Jackie, Stephen, when he's a young boy in wartime Croatia. He's about to behold sheer terror.
What Stephen is seeing is both a communist partisan and a Muslim partisan kill his Catholic father. Now, his Catholic father also happens to be Ustashi, which was the Nazi-affiliated military in Croatia during World War II. Of course, it's fascinating to me that you have a Nazi, a communist, and a Muslim. They're all at each other's throats. And one of them's going to be the ultimate winner, and it's the boy, because he and his mother will be rescued by an American soldier who will marry the mom and move them to Pittsburgh, and the boy will grow up to be fervent, zealous, anti-communist, Cold War Catholic warrior.
Stephen becomes basically a spy, and he has this incredibly weird, strange relationship with Jackie. She's always calling him Daddy. It reminds me of the Sylvia Plath poem, Daddy.
Right. Every woman loves a fascist.
Yeah. There are incestuous overtones in their relationship. Tell us a little bit about this father-daughter story.
What I wanted to explore through it was the dark side of male sexuality. And I think I'm a normal male, and that dark side gets played out in fantasy and imagination, and it's fine, but it's there. The difference between me and a pedophile would be if I see a 14-year-old girl and think she's sexually attractive, I can go imagine whatever I want about that. But a pedophile has no imagination. He has to act on the attraction. The problem in writing about it was trying not to be too heavy-handed.
Do you think that the power that so many of the men in your pages have, you really are showing the seeds of policy, the sense of domination, conquering?
Right. I don't know. When you meet powerful men or just read about them in the newspapers, you see that they don't have a sense of boundaries. And that goes from things like, well, let's go kick some butt in Syria, to oh, look at that beautiful woman. I want her. She's mine. But when you see a family malfunction, all the patterns and the dynamics that you see eroding the structure of that family, you can find those same dynamics all the way up the chain of society, all the way to the ruling class and the top of government.
Yeah. I don't want to give the end of this book away, Bob, but...
Thanks.
But the woman at the center of it, this person who starts out as a lost and unappealing photojournalist, she has to endure this really chaotic sense of oppression, and she's a lot more sympathetic by the time we leave her. Did you have a lot of sympathy for this character as you created her?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think the biggest challenge of the book, besides just the dread of doing the ugly sexuality and the violence, I mean, it felt like a type of punishment I had inflicted on myself. But the biggest challenge was to introduce a reader to a woman who is rather unappealing and reverse that reader's feeling about that woman by the end of the book. I'm pretty sure I did that. I certainly did it in my own heart, it's very easy for me to start grieving, thinking about this woman and who she was when she had a chance to be herself.
That's Bob Chakotchis. He's the author of the new novel, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jackie.
Last week, the George Washington University's National Security Archive got hold of declassified CIA documents confirming an open secret that the U.S. government played a big role in deposing Iran's prime minister in 1953. It's a tangled Cold War story, chock full of spycraft, oil, and intrigue. And it all began on May 1, 1951, when Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh nationalized the British-run Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. The British had discovered Iranian oil decades earlier and built the industry from scratch, and they were not going to give it up without a fight. So they turned to the United States for help, arguing that a communist takeover, not just oil, was at stake. It was a mission for America's new spy agency, the CIA, and what would follow became the template for decades of future spycraft around the globe. To break down Iran's 1953 coup for us and what it means today, 60 years after that summer, we're speaking with Mazyar Bahari. He's an Iranian filmmaker who made a documentary about this called An Iranian Odyssey. He joins us from the BBC studios in London. Mazyar, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Jackie.
Mohammad Mossadegh, tell us who he was.
Mohammad Mossadegh was a nationalist politician. He was Western educated, and he also had a very, very deep knowledge of Iranian politics, tradition, and religion. He believed that Iran's main problem at that time was that it was a country basically ruled by foreign empires, and he meant the British and the Russians. We are talking about the late 1940s and early 1950s. The American Empire at the time had a very good reputation in Iran. The Americans helped Iranian independence in 1946 when the Russians did not leave a province of Iran after the Second World War. And Mossadegh regarded the Americans as an ally against the British.
So what Mossadegh wanted, basically, from the UK originally was money, right? He had offered to buy them out, the now nationalized Anglo-Iranian oil company. When they didn't want that, he offered a 50-50 split. They didn't want that. So part of this was he wanted financial help.
Basically, yes. To the British, because they discovered the oil and created the Iranian oil industry from scratch, it was a fair deal that they shared the revenue with the Iranian government. But to many Iranians, especially those who did not remember that there was no oil in Iran before the British came, it was just unfair for a British company to have a monopoly over Iranian oil. And for the British, Iranian oil was their biggest wealth in the empire. And Mossadegh had to go in order for the British to keep their monopoly over the oil. And at the same time, if Mossadegh's nationalization of oil, if the Iranian state could take over the oil, it would create a bad example for other countries. And because of that, there was this international conspiracy to topple Mossadegh.
Let's talk about what Western agents then do. We've got quite a cast of characters here. We can't possibly go into them all. We've got diplomats, we've got the CIA, we've got MI6 in Britain, British oil executives, all of these people doing something behind the scene to try to build opposition to bring Mossadegh down.
I think a lesser man would fall within a week. Mossadegh was a very strong politician and a very strong man. And because of that, he survived more than 2 years. Everything worked against him. In 1953, the CIA was only 6 years old. And these guys, they came out of the Second World War. They won the war. They were quite arrogant, and they just thought that, you know, Iran was their turf, and they managed to buy newspaper editors, to pay the hoodlums. They organized rallies in different cities. They created a fake communist party in order to create troubles. And because of that, they managed to bring down Mossadegh to his knees.
So almost exactly 60 years ago, a coup attempt begins on the 15th of August with the CIA backing it and the help of an Iranian general. This coup initially fails, but 4 days later, the Americans and their allies regroup. Tell us what happens then.
The coup was supposed to happen on the 15th of August, 1953. Mossadegh is notified by the communists. They foiled the coup, and the coup fails. But Kermit Roosevelt Jr., who was the head of the CIA operations in the Middle East.
The grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He sends a telegraph to the CIA headquarters. He says that we will carry on our mission. The CIA headquarters, they ask him to stop the operation. But Kermit Roosevelt just says that, you know, I never heard that. And he carries on the operation. And
wow.
He succeeds.
Wow. This all happened 60 years ago. The CIA has now admitted its role. Why are we still talking about this coup?
It's kind of left a bitter taste in Iranians' mouth, and they associated Shah's dictatorship with American support. I have to mention that many people who are in power, including Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of the Iranian Revolution, they were helping the Americans in 1953 to bring down Mossadegh. But people have, you know, in all around the world, people have short-term memories and they forget about these things. It's created a very good excuse for the Iranian government to exploit the genuine grievances of the Iranian people.
Masiar, you made your film a couple of years ago. We now have this declassified document. Does it change anything for you?
No, the documents, these are like well-known secrets. And when you talk to the aging CIA agents mm-hmm. these days, they do not regret the coup because they wanted to prevent the advance of communists in Iran. Mm-hmm. But they regret the unconditional support that the Americans gave the Shah after the coup.
It didn't end well. That's Masiar Bahari. He's an Iranian filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist. And you can watch his film about Iran's coup, An Iranian Odyssey, Mossadegh, Oil, and the 1953 CIA Coup on his website, iranwire.com. Masiar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
Irish poet Seamus Heaney died this week at the age of 74. Heaney won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1995 and has been described as the most important Irish poet since Yeats. After he learned of Heaney's death, Irish politician Eamon Gilmore said in a statement, "His poetry explained us to ourselves. In his work, the dignity and honor of everyday lives of people came to life." I spoke with Seamus Heaney on this program in 2008, and he told me of a poem inspired by his childhood in Northern Ireland.
Mossbourne, my first house, was beside the railway, and along the railway there ran telegraph wires, and along the telegraph wires there used to run raindrops, and we used to think the telegrams were sent in the raindrops, so this is called The Railway Children. When we climbed the slopes of the cutting, we were eye level with the white cups of the telegraph poles, and the sizzling wires. Like lovely freehand, they curved for miles east and miles west beyond us, sagging under their burden of swallows. We were small and thought we knew nothing worth knowing. We thought words travelled the wires in the shiny pouches of raindrops, each one seeded full with the light of the sky, the gleam of the lines, and ourselves. So infinitesimally scaled, we could stream through the eye of a needle.
In a genre that can be overlooked, Heaney managed something special. Ordinary readers loved him. And even as he grew as a public figure, Heaney said his writing was still intensely personal.
I have always thought of poems as stepping stones in one's own sense of oneself. Every now and again you write a poem that gives you self-respect and steadies you going a little bit farther out in the stream. At the same time, you have to conjure the next stepping stone because the stream, we hope, keeps flowing. The challenge for the writer, book by book, is to conjure a stepping stone that carries you forward.
As we ended our interview, Heaney recalled one final poem.
This poem is about discovering joy just in writing again. Mm-hmm. It's called Fosterling. It begins, remembering pictures in school that I went to. At school, I loved one picture's heavy greenness. Horizons rigged with windmills, arms and sails. The mill houses still outlines. Their in-placeness still more in place when mirrored in canals. I can't remember not ever having known the imminent hydraulics of a land of glare and glit and floods at Delagon. My silting hope, my lowlands of the mind. Heaviness of being. And poetry sluggish in the doldrums of what happens. Me waiting until I was nearly 50 to credit marvels, like the tree clock of tin cans the tinkers made. So long for air to brighten, time to be dazzled, and the heart to lighten.
Seamus Heaney, speaking on this program in 2008. He died on Friday in Dublin. He was 74. If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and it's time now for music. Snarling, raw, utterly compelling, this is the song Rebel Girl from the 90s band Bikini Kill. The song is iconic in the Riot Girl movement, an offshoot of punk that's openly feminist and encourages girls to come up to the front at shows and on stage. Bikini Kill broke up in the late 90s. Its frontwoman, Kathleen Hanna, stopped putting out music for almost a decade as a result of a long illness. Now in her early 40s, she's drawing rave reviews with a new band called Julie Lewis. The band evolved out of a solo project that Hanna started around the time Bikini Kill was phasing out.
The kind of emotional reality of the situation was I was really pretty depressed. My band was winding down. They're my family. My band, Bikini Kill, had been my life for a really long time. And I needed some kind of outlet for all the feelings that I was having of trying to figure out, who am I if I'm not the lead singer of this band?
You know, right out of the gate, the first song on this record, Oh Come On, is really powerful. It's so upbeat, it's so dancey. The lyrics, though, a little more of an ominous overtone. You know, I thought, wow, this really reminds me of what I loved about the power and the rawness and the edge, if you will, of Bikini Kill itself. Were you going back to those ideas?
I don't even think I really needed to go back to them. You know, I still feel the pressure of, you know, oh, you're supposed to represent this thing because you're a woman in music. And I think that's really frustrating to any marginalized person who's in a, you know, non-traditional job where it's like you're supposed to represent your entire kind of group of people. And a lot of that frustration came out in that song and also, you know, the conflicting things of being a female performer where people are like, you know, I did a photo shoot recently where someone was like, okay, I want you to look really soft and really pretty, but very angry. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, how can you be all of these different things? And in that song, I was trying to just write about that, about how in the end, all you can do is just, you know, and do you.
Let me go back to the album. If there's one favorite, I mean, I'd hate to have to choose, but I've got to say, I wanted to be back in some earlier version of my life. so that Girls Like Us could be my anthem.
Girls like us like cotton candy, plastic handbags, alcohol. Girls like us sometimes ignore people on the street, even though they're people that we know. Girls like us sneak breaks at Wendy's, and girls like us invented jazz. Girls like us have no foundations, Christian myths are so passe.
Tell me a little bit about how this song came to be. Give me more of the lyrics. What's going on here?
You tell me. The lyrics are really kind of random. It's like, girls like us eat salt for breakfast. Girls like us stand back to back. They're kind of an anthem for the people who there is no anthem for. You know, it's meant to be kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing of like, we're all different. I thought that song was a really playful way to say, there is no girl like us. You know what I mean? There's just as many different kinds of feminism as there are women in the world.
My guest is Kathleen Hanna. She was the front woman for the legendary punk band Bikini Kill. She's going back on the road with her new band, The Julie Ruin. You were forced to take a long time out. It is your first album in 9 years. People were wondering what had happened, and recently it came to light that you were suffering very seriously from an undiagnosed illness. Would you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I have late-stage Lyme disease, and I still, you know, have good days, bad days, good weeks, bad weeks, and I'm still in long-term treatment. It's been a tough 9 years, and I didn't think that I would ever be performing again, and that was a very bitter pill to swallow along with the other 84 pills I take every day.
Well, it's always, there's nothing like a brush with mortality to focus the mind, you know, in a very crystalline way. There's a song on this album, Good Night, Goodbye.
It happens when you're not 20 by 41. And you have to sink into the you you've now become. Will the teenage sneer you so called to sneer back at you and make you feel so hated.
You know, to me, I thought that's almost a song that any of us in midlife could write to our younger selves. Are you on good terms with the woman who started Bikini Kill?
I think I am now. I've kind of made peace with the mistakes that I've made and also feeling proud of what I've made. I think that people who are involved in community activism, it's like, don't stand out. We're all equal, you know, especially if you come from a punk rock background that's anti-hierarchy. And I always had this thing of like, don't be a leader. And I think that fed into me not being able to say, hey, wait, that was really cool what I did. I had to, you know, downplay the interesting things that I had made, kind of even to myself. And I'm still as pissed off as ever before. I think I'm just a little bit more directed. I have a better direction for my anger. It's less kind of loosey-goosey all over the place. And I'm more apt to look at a larger worldview than just, you know, what's going on inside my apartment building. And now I think both the 21-year-old and the 41-year-old are pretty happy with each other, so...
Kathleen, let's just take this out on one song. Let's talk a little bit about Run Fast. That seems like a real tribute to you and what you've been through.
Yes, let her with each other.
It's a tribute to my friends from when I was 12 or 13. I really had no idea what that song was going to be about until I just one day in practice started singing it. And it always brings me back to living in the suburbs and having guys yell stuff out of the window of their cars and, you know, riding my bike in Rock Creek Park and doing something so liberating but also feeling afraid. And to me, it was a really, really personal song, and I was trying to connect feeling that way. And then in the end, being in a band and taking over the stage and realizing I had to contend with some of the same exact male dominance that had become a creepy force in my life before. You know, I tried to be really honest. It's some adult content in there, so you might not want to have your 5-year-old dancing around to it, but maybe you do.
Kathleen Hanna is the singer and frontwoman for the group The Julie Ruin. You can hear the band's album, Run Fast, in its entirety at nprmusic.org. Kathleen Hanna, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thanks, Jackie.
The staff includes Catherine Fox, Shula Newman, Deb George, Liz Baker, Andrew Fishman, Rachel Rood, Elliot Hannon, Sarah Ventry, Chris Connolly, Friska Neely, Tom Dreispack, Phil Harrell, and Becky Hersher. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Miponi Maturi is senior editor. Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thank you for listening.